It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, results are in from yesterday's primaries for fall elections around the country. We check those out with our weekly congressional expert.
First, it's been a rough week for General Motors. Yesterday, the company announced the recall of nearly 2.5 million vehicles worldwide, and just today announced an additional recall of more than 200,000 other vehicles.
That brings GM's estimated recall total to more than 13 million cars this year in the United States. That breaks the previous annual record of 10.75 million cars in 2004. So where does General Motors go from here?
Here to give us an update on some of the latest recall news is Jesse Toprak, chief analyst at Cars.com. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with today's news. We've got another 218,000 recalled cars. Tell us about the model affected and what the problem is.
Well, today's news are affecting the Chevrolet Cobalt, and this is actually going to go back to about 2004 models, and it's going to bring the total up to about over 3 million vehicles. What we're seeing right now is GM is really trying to get all these issues out of the way, it appears, and hope to start the next year with a clean slate after working on all these accumulated potential issues.
Yesterday, we also had the news that there were 2.4 million GM cars being recalled. And this is a lot in a couple of days. Can you give us a sense about what's happening at GM? Why are these recalls coming so fast on one another's heels?
Well, just to put the numbers in perspective, GM recalled over 13.6 million vehicles since February. And that number is about the five times the number that they've sold in the U.S. in the last 5 years. So it's certainly a staggering number. What's happening right now, I believe, is that certainly there have been a lot of quality control issues that's evident by the numbers. But what the company is trying to do is head issues head on, take responsibility, and basically tackle all the potential remaining problems as soon as possible so that they can move on from this, you know, a bit of a mess of the recall and move from the negative press that's created by the recalls. So this is a mad rush, so to speak, to tackle any potential issues that might come about so that you're going to see them being a lot more proactive. It's going to look pretty bad for this year, but the hope is that this will be mostly handled with a more clean slate for the manufacturer for the following years.
So you're basically saying that GM is trying to really mind its P's and Q's to run a tight ship and to get out ahead of whatever bad news could be coming down the pike because they can't really afford any more bad news.
No, because this is as bad as it gets in terms of the numbers. It's also costly, too. Actually, the cost of the recalls for them in the first quarter, they took $1.3 billion in loss, and they're expected to take another $400 million in loss, just the cost of repairs of the recalls in the second quarter. So there is the immediate cost of the actual repairs, and there is the long-term, perhaps more costly portion of the negativity created by the recalls. So there's certainly a year that GM will want to forget.
Now, GM had been a success story of sorts. It had come back from the brink of bankruptcy. What is this going to do to that narrative?
You know, it's interesting because we try to always look at what happens with the recalls and its impact on the marketplace. And so far, there has been very little sales impact of the actual recalls. In fact, GM sales are up about 7% this year, and the stock price has not been affected much at all. And I think the thinking is that, hey, if the company is now handling the issues, what matters for the consumers today and into the future is what the car's quality going to be from this point on, not what happened in the past. And that's how the stock market looks at it too, evidently. So I think, you know, the good news is that there has not been a big hit. And also a lot of the models that were affected, except for a few models, were older models, not the new models that they're selling, hence the limited impact on sales. So when you look at the overall improvement of GM, it's actually a much, much better company than it was just 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The product portfolio they have is the best they've ever had. It's unfortunate that they have to deal with these issues now, but this is not a set of problems that GM can't handle, and they're doing the right thing by being proactive at the moment.
And so if you're a consumer and you're looking to buy a GM vehicle right now, are you thinking, you know, this is in the past, these are older vehicles that are being affected, and basically, you know, GM has to be on top of it right now. Maybe their quality control is even better than other manufacturers. So if you're buying a car now, maybe it doesn't matter.
That's true. So there are two different groups of consumers when it comes to the impact of recalls. One is the loyal customers that are going to buy GMs and or customers that were inclined to buy GM brands, and that's exactly what we hear as a feedback, that they probably are better now than they were before. The only negative impact we've seen is for the group of consumers that are undecided. These are completely undecided consumers that have no brand loyalty. When they're looking at and researching cars online, which as most of us do now nowadays, they may simply take GM vehicles out of their consideration list based on the negative news. So that's the one negative aspect that they may that impact GM, but we haven't really seen that show up itself too dramatically in the sales numbers so far.
The whole thing has been pretty humiliating, it seems like, for GM until this point. CEO Mary Barra has been scolded publicly by Congress as well, and had to, you know, put on her best face and talk about how GM going forward would certainly improve its image and its quality controls. How is that going over at the executive level at GM?
Well, it's a tough proposition, a tough position for Barra to be in, because clearly she could not have possibly known every single defect. And there's, you know, hundreds of engineers, many suppliers. You know, an average car has got, you know, over 10,000 parts that comes from different places. Clearly someone needs to answer, and as you, when you're head of a company, that's kind of your role, like it or not. But it's also a bit unfair to put everything on her or the exec team now. These issues have been brewing over the last decade, and clearly there were mistakes made in the process over the years. I think, you know, the initial response from Barra perhaps has not been perfect in terms of owning up to the issues, but I believe the tone right now is right. It's about owning the issues, fixing the issues, and moving on with much better quality and just the cars that people want to buy.
And going forward from here, what does GM need to do to establish itself or reestablish itself as a solid car company?
Well, step one is to take care of the outstanding issues, handle all the outstanding recalls swiftly, take care of the customers when they come to dealerships, and just the relationship with the clients, with whoever shows up, has to be very positive. It's also interesting that having been at the dealership end a long time ago, these recalls can be good sales opportunities for dealerships, because when you go to a dealership, you might end up buying something else. You just never know. But going forward, it's all about really making the cars that people want to buy. It's that simple. When you do that, though, you also need to keep your eye on quality. Right now, the quality and safety of the vehicles can be detrimental to sales, as we've seen in the past. And it's a matter of combining the style value with safety and marketing it properly. It's a simple formula, but it's tough to pull off. Overall, though, I would say GM's prospects are positive. Their presence in the U.S. is strong. Their market share has grown a bit. They also have a lot to expect in terms of growth from markets like China in the next several years.
Great. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for catching us up and joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Jesse Toprak, chief analyst at Cars.com. He joined us to talk about the latest GM recalls.
It's time for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Well, establishment Republicans came away with a strong win in yesterday's congressional primaries, beating Tea Party challengers like those who threatened longstanding members of Congress in the last few election cycles.
And after meeting with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, President Obama spoke to the public today about reports that 40 veterans died while waiting for care at the Phoenix VA hospital. Meanwhile, Congress is considering legislation that would make it easier to fire VA officials.
Paul Singer joins us each Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, the reports seem pretty consistent, calling yesterday's primaries a big victory for the Republican establishment, mainstream Republicans, whatever you want to call them, over activists from the right. Is this just a blip for the Tea Party, or is the tide turning here?
You know, it's hard to tell. They had a couple of races here that early in the cycle looked like they were going to be really barn burners. And they just didn't pan out that way. Most of them actually faded out several weeks ago. I think the real billboard race here was Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader. Excuse me, he would like to be the majority leader. Senate minority leader. He was running against a Tea Party challenger named Matt Bevin, who was well-funded. He was a wealthy man, so he was spending his own money. And there was a thought several months ago that could really be tough for McConnell, because McConnell signed the fiscal cliff deal with Obama. He was seen as, in some Tea Party circles, as selling out to end the government shutdown. But none of it stuck, and then ultimately Bevin was not able to get traction, and last night McConnell crushed him. I mean, it was like 30-point margin or something like that.
And this story, similar stories were told in other races around the country. Are mainstream establishment Republicans learning things from 2010, 2012?
Yeah, I think that's a really smart observation. That's right. It's what's happening. Orrin Hatch, several years ago, had a race coming up like this. And Orrin Hatch had been in the Senate for, about 1,000 years. And it was 2 years to go. He dove into his state from Utah. He went back and he spent significant time in the state. He made friends. He spent a lot of money. He was on the ground all the time, and he got his face in front of people. So they remembered he was there, and they remembered that he mattered. And it really put out a playbook for these guys. A lot of them are now taking the same basic playbook, which is engage, 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 and spend a lot of money early. Don't get caught by surprise. I think you'll see the alternative is in Kansas, where Senator Pat Roberts is fighting claims that he basically doesn't even live in his state. And in a place where he should be easily reelected, he's going to have trouble in his primary because he can't prove that he's been there.
And I've seen some response from national Tea Party organizations saying, yeah, our candidates didn't win, but we've been successful because we're making those incumbents run to the right and commit themselves to policies closer to our liking.
Well, that is a very interesting point. It is a double-edged sword. That may very well be correct. What they are saying is, yeah, our candidate lost, but our issues won, because in order to win, the candidate had to stand closer where we stand on the issues. Now, of course, the Democrats are saying the exact same thing, which is, yeah, in order to win, these Republican, sort of mainstream Republicans, have had to be much more conservative, and therefore that's going to be good for the Democrats, because now they're going to have to run back to the center from where they were during their primaries, and that'll be a challenge for them.
We mentioned, of course, Mitch McConnell. What were a couple of the other big Tea Party versus establishment Republican primaries you were watching?
Well, one of the interesting ones was in Georgia. Georgia is a state where the Democrats have a nominee they like, Michelle Nunn, who's the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn. And they were sort of, Democrats were excited because some of the candidates in that race were very conservative and in some ways a little offbeat that could have been alienating to a general election electorate. Ultimately, there was one candidate down there we were very interested in named Handel. She was the choice of Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. Karen Handel. Sarah Palin had endorsed her, and that really boosted her campaign all of a sudden, but she came up short in the primary, and now it's going to be a runoff between two guys who are really sort of GOP establishment guys, Congressman Kingston and a businessman named David Perdue. So that was a race we were watching because we wanted to see whether, Sarah Palin could push somebody over the hump down there. Also worth watching was in Oregon. This is a race the Democrats should be able to win, but it looks like it could be a bit of a challenge for them. And it featured these candidates, Monica Webby, who had been endorsed by Mitt Romney, versus this guy, Jason Conger, who had been endorsed by Rick Santorum. So in some ways, it was a replay of the 2012 Republican primaries. And the Romney Republican won, and the Santorum Republican lost in that primary.
Now, Georgia and Kentucky are two states where the Democrats are hoping to play offense, maybe take away a seat from Republicans. Most of the story of this election is in the other direction.
Right.
Democrats worried that they are not going up against candidates who are likely to shoot themselves in the foot.
Right. Well, that, to some degree, is the outcome of these races, is the Democrats didn't get the candidates they wanted. There is some suspicion that the Democrats have been behind a bunch of leaks out in Oregon that were designed to make Monica Wiebe look like, you know, a woman who was crazy, basically. She was, you know, accused of trespassing and harassment of an old boyfriend some years ago. And the Democrats were sort of circulating this stuff, apparently in an attempt to get a better candidate to run against, somebody who would be seen as a little more outside the mainstream. So, yeah, I mean, maybe now the Democrats are facing the candidates they don't want because they didn't get the candidates who they can paint as real radicals.
Before we move on from elections, what are the next couple primaries you are keeping your eye on?
You know, I knew you were going to ask that question. I'm just at the moment trying to remember this. I know June 3rd there are a couple of primaries that we're interested in. There will be, I think there's an Alabama primary that may be mildly interesting. And I'm just, oh, Iowa, that's the one. I apologize. Right, it's the Iowa one where, again, Democrats had a good candidate, have a good candidate, and are excited about their candidate, but he's stepped in it a couple of times in the past few weeks, and now the Republicans think they have a nice opportunity, and there's a woman named Jody Ernst who's been endorsed again by Sarah Palin, and the question is whether she can take over that race in Iowa. That'll be June 3rd.
We'll be watching those in future shows. Well, moving on to other news this morning, President Obama spoke to the public about these allegations we've been hearing about misconduct, cover-ups at a VA facility, a hospital in Phoenix. So let's listen to a clip of the president.
Any misconduct, whether it's allegations of VA staff covering up long wait times or cooking the books, I will not stand for it. If these allegations prove to be true, it is dishonorable, it is disgraceful, and I will not tolerate it, period. First, anybody found to have manipulated or falsified records at VA facilities has to be held accountable.
That's the president's response. What are we hearing from Congress about this VA ongoing scandal?
Well, this is going to be an issue. I mean, I think this is one of those scandals that people can really understand and can really appreciate. It is fairly simple. It is catastrophically bad management at a large bureaucratic government agency that may have led to the deaths of veterans who are not getting the care they deserved. That is something that Obama is going to have to spend a lot of time explaining. And one of the things you're hearing from Congress today is that he didn't say anything. He didn't announce anything. He didn't. I mean, all he said basically is we will spend the next few weeks looking at it, and when we figure out who did something wrong, heads are going to roll. But he didn't launch any new initiative. He didn't fire General Shinseki, who's the veteran secretary. There has been some call for him to be fired. In fact, interestingly enough, one of the endangered Democratic members of Congress, who's in a tough re-election race, today called for Shinseki to be fired. So you're going to get a lot of reaction from Congress being, A, we need to know more, we need to know more, we need to know more, and then B, from the Republicans, obviously, you'll see, how come Obama's just discovering this? Where has he been the past 6 years when there has been a lot of reports of backlogs and poor service at VA hospitals?
Well, is any of this outrage being channeled into the form of legislation?
Well, there is a bill kicking around on the House floor, and honestly, I have not yet checked today whether it was supposed to pass today, I think, a bill that would essentially make it easier to punish or fire VA officials who may be responsible for some of this wrongdoing. It's a small step, but it's, I think it's really more than anything else an opportunity for Congress to express its outrage. I think the bigger issue is how do you fix this problem? I mean, and then Obama was making this point during his presentation today that, you know, there are a lot of veterans who are aging now. The baby boomers are aging. They are becoming more dependent on services. We have, you know, a million people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq who are in need of care. And the lists of people needing services at the VA are increasing. And punishing and firing people at the VA is a great thing, but that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. How do we get care to this large and growing larger pool of people who need the care?
We had the commander. We had the national commander of the American Legion on this week. In addition to calling for resignations and changes, he said, "Hey, Congress needs to provide more funding for these facilities to lower these waiting lists." In our last little bit here, is anybody talking about that?
Yeah, people will talk about it, but again, the problem with funding in every case is A, where does the money come from, and B, what good does the money do? I mean, if you're just throwing money at a program that's broken, it doesn't necessarily do you any good. It's an easy solution. It's like, oh, we'll just give me an extra, you know, a couple billion dollars. But something else will have to be cut to make up for that. You still have to figure out how they're spending that $1 billion to make sure that it is doing something good. And what it needs to do is to cut wait times and provide services to veterans.
We'll wrap up there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great week.
That was Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. We check in on the doings in Congress each Wednesday at this time. We've all heard about the birds and the bees, but usually that applies to the sex lives of us, humans. What about the actual sex lives of those bees and birds and the other creatures?
Our next guest says that the more we learn about our animal friends and about their lives below the belt, so to speak, the more we'll understand about evolution, biology, diversity, and the beauty of all nature's life forms.
Joining us now is Menno Schildhusen. He's ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands. His new book is Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. Menno, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, your book, you tell a lot of fascinating stories about the sex lives of animals, insects in particular, but this isn't just for entertainment. Why are animals' sex lives and their sex organs so important to studying evolution?
Well, They're really the places where evolution seems to do its greatest tricks. If you look at insects, I mean, if you look at a number of species of a particular type of bug, to the untrained eye and even to the trained eye, they often seem very similar externally on the outside. But once you look at the way their genitals, their reproductive organs look and function and work, you find great differences even between species that look identical on the outside. So it seems that evolution works fastest and most dramatically in those organs which have directly to do with reproduction. And since evolution is all about reproduction, that's maybe not so surprising.
It's an interesting thing that, you know, it's so important, at least we view it as that today, because for a long time, evolutionary biologists, you know, would kind of push off to the side anybody who wanted to study the genitalia of animals or the sex lives of animals. And they said it just wasn't important. It was a waste of time. What happened to bring it back into the spotlight?
Yeah, what you say is absolutely true. It's very surprising that biologists have been studying the sex organs of plants with abandon for more than a century. That's always been completely mainstream, namely studying flowers and the way insects and birds pollinate flowers, and yet the way these genitalia function has never really taken much interest for many years. And it was really until the 1980s that a scientist called Bill Eberhard of the Smithsonian Institution, he was the first to use all that information that was already available, because people were using these reproductive organs to recognize species and to separate species and to describe them in animals, and started really asking the question, why would all these differences exist? What kind of evolution goes on that makes these species that are so similar on the outside differ so dramatically and so drastically in their sex organs? And it really, I mean, he's really a hero of mine. It's so rare to have a biologist who can look across different subfields within biology and take information from one field and try to apply it somewhere else. And that's really what was needed to bring this kind of study into mainstream evolutionary biology.
Well, let's get into some really basic questions here. From the perspective of a biologist, what is sex, and do all members of the animal kingdom have sex?
Right. If you ask the man in the street what is sex, you get a very different answer from what you get if you ask a biologist. To a biologist, sex or sexual reproduction is a kind of reproduction in which two organisms mix their genetic material and put that mixture into an offspring. There are many ways to do that. I mean, even bacteria can have sex, because they sometimes exchange bits of DNA with other bacteria. even though they're not animals, they don't have males and females, they don't even have sex organs, they don't insert anything into each other, they just transfer a little bit of DNA molecule, and to a biologist, that's sex. But of course, in animals and humans, sex has become almost synonymous with reproduction. So we do that exchanging of DNA while we're reproducing, but that's not necessarily the case. And there are also many other ways of reproducing without having sex. I mean, many organisms clone themselves very simply without having any exchange of DNA.
And I guess to jump off those questions, what is the point of having sex really for the animal kingdom? I mean, it seems like it would be more efficient for an animal to clone itself.
Absolutely. And on paper, it is more efficient because you don't waste time finding mates. You don't have to share your DNA with somebody else. You can make sure that all your offspring have all your DNA. You don't have to water it down with somebody else's. So it's been a very major question in biology for a long time, why there would be sex in the first place and why it is so popular in evolution to have sexual reproduction. Why doesn't everybody clone themselves? So there must be something really important, because it seems to give only disadvantages and no obvious advantages. And the fun involved doesn't qualify as an advantage to biologists. So there are now two main theories, and one is that it's a way to repair errors, reading errors in the DNA. You have these mistakes made when DNA is copied, and all those mistakes are inherited by your offspring, unless you can combine your DNA with somebody else's DNA, which may not have errors in the same places where you have errors in your DNA. So by doing that and by making random combinations of all those errors, you can make sure that your offspring have a great diversity of all those errors, and the bad ones will get weeded out. That's one theory. Another theory is that, again, this variation that you create by mixing DNA with somebody else's and by making sure that all your offspring have a different combination of genes, you can outwit parasites or disease organisms. You could imagine that if you clone yourself, then if you happen to have a gene that makes you susceptible to a disease and all your offspring inherit that same susceptibility, then if this disease strikes, all your offspring will be dead. Whereas if you have genetic variation in your offspring, then some may survive and some may not survive. But at least you have a higher chance that some will survive. And the idea is that this has also been a very important reason very early in the history of life for sex to evolve.
You mentioned the concept of sex as fun earlier. We as humans have evolved to get a pleasure reward from it. Is that normal in the animal kingdom, or are we unique?
I'm sure it's normal, yeah. Of course, it's very hard for us to look into the brain of a slug or a beetle, but I'm sure there is, in all animals, there's some sort of reward system to make sure that that these animals go to the trouble of finding a mate and mating. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. Or you could turn it around and say, if there were any animals in the past in a particular species who didn't like sex, they all died out because they didn't reproduce. So I'm sure the enjoyment that we have, we share that with almost all other life forms that have sexual reproduction.
So if we're going to talk about biodiversity, you really get a sense of how broad things can evolve when you look at the genitalia of, say, insects. And you write about a lot of the bizarre sexual behaviors among insects that, I don't know, they kind of make human bedroom behavior seem pretty boring. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Yeah. Well, it seems, our sex life seems boring because we take it as a norm, but I'm sure from an insect's perspective, ours is very bizarre. Take a bed bug, for example. Those of us who live near bed bugs know them more intimately than we'd like, but even many people who host bed bugs are not aware that these animals practice something that's called traumatic insemination, and traumatic in this sense means physically traumatic, in the sense that trauma means wound in Greek. So what these bed bugs do is the males have evolved a dagger-like penis, and even though the females have a perfectly fine vagina, this is not used during mating. Instead, the male uses this dagger-like penis to inject his sperm directly into the body of the female, and the sperm cells then swim autonomically through the tissues and through all the organs of the female to reach the ovaries. And the female uses her vagina only to lay eggs and not to receive sperm. And there are many other organisms that reproduce in the same way. That's one of the more bizarre ones.
And we'll get into some of the more of those stories in just a few moments. We've got Menno Schulthausen with us. He's author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tells Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves.
We're continuing our conversation about nature's nether regions, what animals' sex lives can teach us about evolution and the incredible diversity of life on Earth. With us now is Menno Schulthausen, ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalist Biodiversity Center in Leiden. He's the author of the new book called Nature's Nether Regions.
And Menno, earlier you mentioned the beetles, who, you know, species might look very similar to one another but have drastically different genitalia. How big are the differences, and why would they evolve so differently?
Yeah. Well, there's the differences can be very big. I myself work with a family of so I do some research on a family of beetles which are called Liodidae. They're very small, brownish, grayish, round beetles that live in the soil, and here in the Netherlands, and I'm sure in many parts of the U.S. too, you can find 10, 15 species sharing the same patch of forest, and they look pretty similar on the outside. And when you then dissect out the male genitalia, the penis, you can find things that are spoon-shaped, you can find things that are fork-shaped, you can find things that are three-pronged, things that have an internal sac with very large teeth on it, or no teeth at all. So the differences are pretty big. I mean, it sometimes could take you an hour to identify a species by looking at the outside characteristics, but as soon as you dissect out the penis, you can tell it within a fraction of a second which species it is.
And is this something that leads to speciation, to species splitting off from each other when they change so much that they can no longer interbreed with ones whose genitalia haven't evolved to keep up with them?
Presumably that also happens, although I would tend to think that the genitals evolve differences somewhat later, so that the speciation is set in motion because of adaptation to different habitats or different niches within the habitat, different kinds of food, and that then splits a species in two, and that then makes that any improvement, any change, any evolution in genitals will remain restricted to each of those species, and that's what causes the differences, which may make it even more unlikely that these two species will be able to crossbreed. But I'm not sure if we have any cases where new species have evolved because they evolved a different kind of genital.
Now, to go back to the insects themselves, or arachnid in this case, one animal that seems like we know a fair bit about in terms of their sex life is the spider. And there are, of course, stories about the female spider. I think it's the black widow, but different spiders, the female eating the male after intercourse. How much of that is true? What do we know about spiders?
Yeah, that's quite true in general, especially with black widow spiders and other kinds of spiders, where the male is much smaller than the female. In most spiders, these females are huge, and the males are tiny. And in those species, it's very common for the male to end up as the female's lunch immediately after mating. And because they have such a poor life expectancy after coitus, you see all very drastic measures evolving in these males, sort of self-sacrificial measures to ensure that the sperm they have delivered to the female is actually going to be used by her to fertilize her eggs. For example, there are many spiders, including those black widows, where the male's genitals actually break off after mating and they remain stuck in her vagina, actually in her vaginas, because she has two, and the male also has two penises on either side of the head, if you can still believe me. And that then plugs the vagina and makes it more difficult for a subsequent male to also insert his penises. So that might actually mean that despite being eaten, such a second male doesn't even get to fertilize the female.
You know, one of the driving forces between these really unique adaptations seems to be, in a lot of species, a battle between the sexes. The male and the female have different interests when it comes to reproducing and evolution. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, that's really what seems to be behind much of this very drastic evolution, the fact that there's a sort of a conflict of interest between males and females in many species. You could imagine that for any male that mates with a female, what would serve his interest best would be if this particular male would use this particular female would use this particular male sperm to fertilize all her eggs with. That would be great from the viewpoint of the male, but for the female, it's often much more beneficial to not to put all her eggs in one basket, as it were, to have multiple males fertilizing some of her eggs and to pick and choose. So you see that a lot of this evolution in the genitalia is centered around this conflict of interest that certain features of the male genitalia try to ensure that the female uses his sperm to fertilize a lot of her eggs. For example, a lot of males have spines on their penises, which they can use to actually inject substances in the female, which mess with her psychology to make her go off males for a few days after mating, so that at least during that time, he doesn't have to fear any competition from other males. And in females, on the other hand, you often see that there are special pockets, different pockets in which you can store sperm of different males and then use these at will at a later stage.
Wow.
To fertilize her eggs with. For example, a queen ant gets fertilized only during her bridal flight at the beginning of her life, and then she rules the colony sometimes for decades using all that time, using sperm that she stored all those years back from multiple males, and basically deciding for each new egg she lays which male's sperm is going to be used to fertilize those eggs. And so you always have this conflict of interest, and that's probably what drives this enormously fast evolution.
Well, it's interesting, you know, thinking about that. You said earlier that you imagine that there was some sort of pleasure response for animals, and that was probably, you know, partially why they do it, the biological imperative, all of that. But, you know, when you look at these examples, it doesn't seem like much fun. There's a lot of biting and and
stabbing
death and stabbing.
Yeah.
Right. So where does the fun part come in for animals?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know how these animals feel when they're doing these vicious kinds of reproductive behavior. But there's also a lot of sweetness going on. There's a lot of stroking and persuasion, very gentle persuasion going on. A lot of insects have so-called paramires, which are little brushes on the side of their penis. So while they're mating, they're using these to titillate or to brush the female's abdomen. And you can sometimes even see that a female would use one of her hind legs to move those paramires, those little brush-like organs, a little bit to the side, as if she wants to put them in a place that's slightly more pleasurable. So it's not all aggression. There's all kinds of things going on, and how these animals actually feel about that, unfortunately, we have no way of knowing.
One that caught my attention, the male burrowing barnacle seems to be a species that's gone to an extreme. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. The male burrowing barnacle is still slated as the animal in the animal kingdom that has the longest penis relative to its size. It's about 10 times as long as the animal is wide. And it was actually discovered by Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin studied for 8 years. He studied barnacles. He didn't, when he came back from his voyage on the Beagle, he didn't pen down his earth-shattering theory. He studied barnacles for many years. And this is one of the species he described. And he also described this enormously long penis, which has survived as a record holder since then. And, of course, the reason is that barnacles live fixed to rocks, and they cannot themselves go look for partners, so they have to send their penis on a prowl around the barnacle colony to find mates.
And in terms of the animals you studied, and they're also, I mean, all of these examples are sort of so mind-bending from a human perspective, but what's one that really sort of surprised even you?
Well, that's one that's surprisingly not in my book. That was published just a few weeks ago. You may have heard of it. There was a cave louse in Brazil discovered, which sort of seems to have a reversal, where the females have a penis which they use to penetrate the male and to grab his sperm package, which is very nutritious and very valuable for the female, and take it from him in a sort of reversal of sex roles. And I was really disappointed that I didn't know about this particular example before I finished the book, because it would have fitted perfectly, because it shows that in the sexual evolution, it's not really about being male or being female, but it's about who contributes most energy or most resources to the offspring. And in this case, this was the male, and that's what produces this reversal of roles and organs in this particular species.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Menno, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was Menno Schildhausen, ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden in the Netherlands. He's the author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Bees Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves.